Thank you. It is a, it's just a pleasure to stand outside on what's the nicest day of the year so far. I have to, if I give it an extra 10 seconds here. It is especially important to see the familiar faces here today, especially many of the folks in the network that I've worked with for now over 25 years to stand up individually and collectively for the rights of crime victims. And it's important to note those two differences. We have obviously an agenda as a state to continue to make crime victims front and center in our system, but we also have those individual interactions that are so vitally important, the respect, the understanding, the thoughtfulness that make we as Missourians in this important time and at this important day join together as one. So I'm honored to be here today to speak with you for a few moments during Crime Victims Week here in the Show Me State. The theme, Reshaping the Future, Honoring the Past, shows how far we have come in the last three decades to establish and protect the rights of crime victims and how that task is always with us. Those milestones of achievement have included enshrining the rights of crime victims in our state constitution, giving crime victims and their families rights to be in a courtroom, to be notified of proceedings, and to be protected from defendants, establishing and funding domestic violence shelters, victim advocates, and counseling services across our state, and dramatically changing the laws of our state to get tougher on drunk driving by lowering the BAC threshold, and just last year to change the laws so we appropriately punish those who drive and drink repeatedly. It might be a good point to also note that our Highway Patrol under our Department of Public Services this year was awarded the Outstanding Law Enforcement Organization in the United States when dealing with drunken driving, and we honor Deputy Colonel Repogel and Director Britt for their leadership in that regard. Some of you may remember in the State of the State this year we had Stand Up, one of our outstanding troopers who's led the way in career number of arrests for DWI. We went through a reading of the last reading of the State of the State the night before. We finished about 10:30, quarter to 11. I got back the next morning around, came into the office to do another read about 8:30 in the morning. So remember, 10:30, 11:30 at night, back for 8:45. By the time I read through that, there was an edit. That sergeant had had an arrest during the time period of my last reading and the next reading. We had to change the teleprompter because Sergeant Adams was out there working all night to continue to move those numbers forward. We appreciate the colonel's leadership and working to make sure those numbers continue to move up as we continue to enforce the laws of our state. The things I pointed out together before, we've worked together and accomplished these things. And we're going to continue to work together in areas such as domestic violence protection and in stopping human trafficking. You see in our Attorney General efforts in this domestic violence front, continuing to build on the strengths of the past. We appreciate your continued leadership and service, General Koster, in that area. I want to thank each and every person here for your courage and perseverance you have shown in speaking out for yourselves, for your loved ones, and for victims all across our state. We all know how difficult that is to do, but how vitally important it is to have voices, voices from the battle, who will join with us to carry our efforts forward. Your tireless work has meant that crime victims have a voice that will be heard and has laid the foundation upon which we and those who come after us will continue to build. And so it gives me great honor as governor of our state to issue the following proclamation. Whereas it is essential that Missouri crime victims are treated with respect and supported and assisted as they cope with the consequences of crime. And whereas in 2010, more than 227,000 crimes occurred in Missouri, and each of those crimes affected more than just the victim, but also the families, the friends, and the communities. And whereas crime exacts an emotional, physical, psychological, and financial toll on victims as they have lost loved ones, life savings, physical and mental health, and often their sense of security, that have potential to irrevocably change the course of their lives. Whereas more than 30 years of progress for crime victims stands on the shoulders of dedicated advocates and brave victims who overcame shame, isolation, and indifference to gain a voice, to gain rights, and to gain respect. Whereas we applaud the progress that Missouri has made and recognize crime's impact on victims and celebrate advocates and survivors who, through their determination, brought rights and resources for victims and have changed the course of history. Everyone here has been a participant in that changing of the course of history, and I thank you for your leadership. And whereas victims assistance programs in Missouri are reaching more victims and criminal justice officials are honoring victims' rights more consistently, and whereas Missouri continues to work to address the mental health impacts of crime and to meet the needs of victims of nonviolent crime, victims of terrorism, and the other underserved victims, and whereas National Crime Victims Week provides an opportunity for us to reshape the future for victims in Missouri by honoring the past and reflecting on hard-won victories and to recommit to working together to insist on better treatment for victims to help them overcome the harm caused by crime. Now, therefore, I, Jeremiah J. Nixon, Governor of the State of Missouri, do hereby proclaim April 10th through 16th, 2010, to be Crime Victims Rights Week in Missouri. It is an honor to proclaim it. It is an honor to see so many friends and to understand that we stand today not only for the folks that are here, but much more importantly than that, for the thousands of voices that aren't here and can't be heard and won't be heard. And I guarantee as long as I'm in public service, we will continue to do everything within our power to make sure that network grows and as those individuals suffer less. Thank you and Godspeed.
Thank you, Governor Nixon. We know you have a busy schedule, and we appreciate taking the time to be with us today. Thank you. On January 12, 2009, Chris Koster was sworn in as the 14th Attorney General of the State of Missouri. Attorney General Koster has also served in Missouri Senate, representing the 31st District, which covers Cass, Johnson, Bates, and Vernon counties. Prior to his election to the Missouri Senate, Mr. Koster served as the Cass County Prosecuting Attorney for 10 years. As a prosecutor, he supervised litigation in thousands of cases. He led investigations into many of the Kansas City area's most notorious criminal cases, including the investigation and prosecution of serial killer John E. Robinson. Attorney General Koster has recently led a domestic violence task force and has once again demonstrated his commitment to ensuring the crime victims' rights are honored and protected. Please welcome Attorney General Chris Koster.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It is an honor to participate in this ceremony this year, recognizing the rights of crime victims in our state. For those of you in the audience who have been victims of crime or family members impacted by crime, my sympathy goes out to you. And for those of you in the audience who work to help victims and their families navigate this complicated system and repair their lives as much as possible, my deepest admiration goes out to you. My office spends much of its time putting people behind bars or keeping them behind bars. In the past year, we worked to get a guilty plea from a former police captain who sexually abused two young brothers. We successfully argued for the commitment as a sexually violent predator of a man who admitted to abusing more than 12 child victims. And we successfully argued the court case that resulted in the execution of a man who kidnapped, raped, and murdered an 11-year-old girl. And I assure you, for every conviction we get, every time we argue to keep someone in prison, every midnight we wait to see the ultimate punishment carried out, we keep first in mind the victims who bear the scars of these crimes and the family members who suffer with them and, too often, suffer without them. The theme of this year's Crime Victims Rights Week, Reshaping the Future and Honoring the Past, reflects the resiliency with which victims of crime summon the courage to rebuild their lives. For me, the theme also reflects the desire of law enforcement to do all we can to improve this system in which we work, this system that victims of crime must navigate. Last fall, at the urging of Colleen Coble, Chief Executive Officer of the Missouri Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, our office held hearings around the state of Missouri to examine this state's domestic violence laws and identify improvements to our system. Although domestic violence may be personal, it is not private. It's an assault on a person, on a family. It's an assault on a community. Domestic violence affects our schools, our businesses, and our collective safety. Domestic violence is an issue of public safety. And it is in everyone's interest that we promote prevention, hold batterers accountable, and provide security to those in need. At the Domestic Violence Task Force meeting in St. Louis last September, we heard chilling testimony from a victim of domestic violence, Carol Cromer, who you will hear from in just a few minutes. Carol's story of years of terror, despite her doing all she could within the existing law enforcement system, made it clear that we needed to make changes in Missouri in order to truly protect victims of domestic violence. The result of the hearing was a task force report with 12 recommendations for changes in Missouri law and the adoption of best practices from around this state. I'm pleased to report that the recommendations have strong bipartisan support in this General Assembly, and I remain extremely hopeful that this General Assembly will yield the first comprehensive overhaul of Missouri's domestic violence laws in the last 30 years. With Carol's help, we are reshaping our own future. It's not just victims of domestic violence that our office assists. Our office works with all victims who've been affected by crimes that come under our jurisdiction, from misdemeanor crimes to capital murder cases, sexually violent predator cases to white-collar crime. And while there's a story behind every case, and always hurdles to healing, we find that families of our capital murder cases are, of course, the most profoundly affected. There are today 160 family members that the Missouri Attorney General's office is currently working with in 47 separate capital murder cases, enduring unimaginable long-term suffering from the brutal murder of their loved one through the trial, onto the appeals, and the endless wait for an execution date. Although our criminal justice system is the best in the world, it is not kind to family members of victims who must deal with the long capital murder process. We are privileged in our system to often witness the endurance of the human spirit as these families work to reshape their own future. One family our victim advocates are working with embodies that spirit. Little 6-year-old Casey was abducted and murdered in 2002. The offender's case is still making its way through the appeals process some 9 years later. Instead of letting this crime crumble their lives, Casey's family has found a way to honor Casey and touch a great many parents and children in our state. In Casey's memory, this family has organized an annual Children's Safety Fair each year held in May. It has grown into a large event. The fair funds a scholarship in the honor of Casey, and private and corporate contributions also aid this scholarship fund. A scholarship is awarded each year to a deserving high school graduate, and this will continue until the year 2014, the very year that Casey would have graduated from high school. In 2014, the family will distribute all of the remaining funds to Casey's classmates as part of her graduation, and each classmate planning to further his or her education will receive a check from Casey. This family is reshaping the future and honoring the past in a way that renews all of us and recommits our efforts to fighting every day to prevent and to punish all of these senseless acts. It is my honor to be with you today and to fight alongside you. I thank you for your friendship, but mostly I thank you for the support that you give this cause, Missouri's victims of crime, and those who love and care for them. Thank you.
Thank you, General Koster. At this time, I'd like to take a moment to recognize the Missouri Music Makers, who are going to present a song of their choice. Beautiful. This time, I would like to introduce our next speaker, Mr. Dean Dankelson. Mr. Dankelson has been a prosecutor since 1993. In 1999, he was elected prosecuting attorney of Jasper County. He is currently serving his fourth term as the elected prosecutor of Jasper County. Mr. Dankelson also serves as an adjunct faculty member teaching criminal justice at Missouri Southern State University. He is a past president of the Children's Center of Southwest Missouri, a child advocacy center with four locations serving 11 counties. He is currently serving his second year as president of the Missouri Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. Please welcome Dean Dankelson.
Good afternoon. When we were planning today's event, Jason asked me just to take care of one thing, and that was the weather. So that was the only thing I was responsible for today, and it is a beautiful day. When I was a student up at the University of Missouri, I developed a bad habit, and that was when somebody started talking about statistics, I started tuning out because I'm not a big fan of statistics. So in light of that, I'm going to read you two statistics. First, during a one-year period, 60.6% of children and youth from birth to age 17 experience at least one direct or indirect victimization of a crime. Second, almost half of children and youth from birth to 17 experienced a physical assault, one in four a property offense, one in 10 child maltreatment, and 6% suffer from a sexual victimization. And I read those statistics, which number one amazed me, but it really, really did surprise me. And as somebody who's worked in this area for a long time, I started thinking, could those statistics be true? And as I usually do, I drew upon my own family experience. I have three children. The oldest of now is 13, my daughter just turned 12, and my youngest son is 10. And I recall that an incident that occurred as we were driving home from visiting my family in Ohio for Thanksgiving. We stopped in a town here in Missouri and spent the night as we were driving home. My wife and I and my then infant son finished our drive home, and when we arrived back in Carl Junction, I started unloading the car, and I asked my wife if she had removed anything from the car that I didn't know about, and she told me no. And it was then I had realized that during the night, as we had stopped at the hotel, somebody had broken into our car and had stolen some of our luggage. And fortunately, it was just stuff, and as my wife was crying and upset, I guess I kicked back into prosecutor mode and reassured her that it was just things because she and I and our youngest son were okay. But what really was disturbing is that they stole our camcorder. And on the camcorder still had the tape from the hospital and the birth of our son, and that tape has been forever taken from us. I still have my son and I still have my wife, but we had lost the opportunity to view that memory again. And so my oldest son has been a direct victim of a crime. And as I thought about my daughter, and I went to visit her at school last week because it was her birthday, and because my wife was at work, I was the one who had to take the ice cream to school. And as I'm taking the ice cream to school, I notice an odor in the school and remembered that there had been a fire set in the school the day before. One of the other sixth graders thought it would be funny to go into to the men's room and set things on fire. And the fire spread, and there was major smoke damage. And in fact, there were classrooms that were displaced because of the smell and the odor. And my daughter's class had been displaced because of the damage that had been done to the school as a result of the fire. So as I look at the statistic, which mentions 60% of all children in any year suffer from a victimization, I look at two or three of my three children have been the victim of a crime. And so it leads me to believe that that statistic is true. Now, I firmly believe that we judge a society by how we treat our children. And I was proud to be part of something in Carl Junction last week that we're doing a new program that started in Joplin called Bright Futures. And although it has nothing directly to do with crime victims and has nothing directly to do with the criminal justice system, programs like that are a great program because what we're trying to do is help those in our society who are underprivileged and need assistance and hook them up with folks who can help them. And that's a good model for us to use in the criminal justice system. And as I look out here and see all you wonderful people, some of whom I've become friends with, and look at how you help those who are victimized by crime, I echo what Attorney General Koster said. I really thank you for the job you do. And if there's one thing that I have the privilege of doing today, representing all 115 prosecutors in the state of Missouri, you know, all throughout the state, and that's the privilege of looking at you folks who work tirelessly every day to protect those who are victimized by crime, and look at you and say thank you. Thank you for the job you do. Thank you for helping those in our society who need help. Thank you to our members of law enforcement who work every day to protect us and keep us safe. Thank you to everybody in the criminal justice system who works to keep our system going so that we can try to bring justice to those who deserve that justice. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And one thing I have learned speaking after the governor and the attorney general and before our featured speaker who's coming next is to keep it brief, so I will do that. But on behalf of all the prosecutors, thank you for allowing me to be here today.
Our featured speaker today is named Carol Cromer. Carol is a mother of three, a grandmother of six, and lives in St. Charles, Missouri. Carol and her family were stalked and terrorized by her ex-husband for many years. Carol is grateful to share her story in hopes of improving how Missouri's systems respond to crime victims, but we are grateful for her perseverance and her strength and her being with us today. Please welcome her.
Good afternoon. I would like to thank the Missouri Coalition of Domestic and Sexual Violence for all their hard work, dedication on this serious issue, and for giving me the honor and privilege of speaking here today. I want to especially thank my family and dear friends for all their generous support during the difficult times and for their continued support today. I am a survivor of domestic violence. My story began in 2002 when I married for the second time. My husband and I had children from our first marriages, but never had children together. We had dated for 3 years prior to the marriage. My husband appeared to be a very kind, caring, and well-respected man within the community. He worked for the police department and ATF. He was an investigator for the bomb and arson unit, K-9 division. Following the wedding, he moved into my home and began almost immediately showing signs of controlling and obsessive behavior. I was unable to do anything without his knowledge and approval. He called repeatedly and would go through the trash, my phone records, and my car. He took my phone away on numerous occasions. For me, it was emotional abuse, mind games, and threats. He never physically abused me. I had no scars, no bruises, no broken bones. I found out that my husband was not the person he claimed to be. Everything he had told me had been a lie. In November of 2005, he became angry and threatened me with a gun. I left and temporarily moved into my daughter's home and filed for divorce. He began stalking me and hired others to follow me. I filed for an order of protection. 4 days after filing, he became a danger to my children, and they became the targets of his vicious attacks. At approximately 3 a.m. in the morning, my daughter's car caught fire in front of her apartment. It was a total loss. This occurred in my husband's district, an area of expertise. His department was informed of our concerns. Later that morning, my husband showed up at my work and dropped off an envelope that read, "Rethink this." I called the police to make a report. It had been 6 days since filing for the order of protection, but my husband had not yet been served. The police officer made contact with him and proceeded to serve him. Exactly 2 weeks later, again at approximately 3 a.m., my son's car exploded and burned in his driveway along with my daughter's second car, which was also in the driveway at the time. My son was inside the house asleep and did not hear the explosion. The fire was so hot that it moved to the house, and if not for the quick response of a neighbor and the local fire department, this could have easily become a fatal consequence. Once again, this occurred in my husband's district, an area of expertise. His department was again contacted with our concerns. Later that morning, I contacted Internal Affairs. His department was again contacted with our concerns. His department sent out an independent investigator to review the two fires. Both were undetermined, probably electrical, with nothing more they could do. By the way, my husband was also an electrician. Over the next 3 weeks, my husband continuously drove through the parking lot where I worked. I contacted Internal Affairs two more times. I made at least 6 reports of violation of the ex parte. He denied all of them. I was unable to get the full order of protection because every time a hearing was scheduled, he managed to have it continued. He knew the system better than most, so getting the full order of protection actually took over 1 year to accomplish. My husband used the divorce proceedings to pull all my information. One evening after work, I walked to my car in the parking lot when I saw my husband sitting in his car watching me. I jumped into my car and drove directly to the nearest police station. When contacted by the police, he denied being there again. 1 hour later, I received a disturbing message on my voicemail. I took my phone to the police and filed another report. I then contacted his son to inform him of his father's increasingly strange behavior. His son called me later that evening, explaining that his dad's intentions that night were to kill me and then himself. He had meticulously laid out instructions for his son as well as clothing for the funerals. He was admitted that night to a hospital psychiatric unit. He was evaluated for 1 week, given medication, and released. 2 days later, letters arrived at several of my family's homes. My husband had mailed them prior to coming after me. They explained why he had to kill me and blamed them for everything. Throughout the next couple of months, things were fairly quiet. We were in the process of planning my youngest daughter's wedding and looking forward to the birth of my oldest daughter's third child, due around the same time. The fun was overshadowed by occasional unexplained hang-up phone calls that would come in through the middle of the night. My husband continued to drive through the parking lot where I worked day after day. Reports were made. He took things out of my car. When confronted, he denied being there. I was becoming more and more desperate. He knew just what to do. I was told by police that their hands were tied unless we could show some kind of proof. I was finally able to get that proof. Friends of mine actually came to my office and sat at the window all day waiting just to get him on videotape, and they did. Another report was made, and once again he lied about his whereabouts, but this time I had proof. 2 days later, my youngest daughter woke up to a threatening note that had been left through the night on the windshield of her car. I think you can imagine, with her upcoming wedding only weeks away, the fear she experienced as she read the note. "I did not get my invitation," it read, "but I'll be there. It'll be a blast." Again, a police report was made. 3 days later, he was arrested on charges of stalking with a bond set at $1,000, a misdemeanor. He was out on bail within hours and more volatile than ever. One evening, around midnight, a pipe bomb exploded on the back deck of my oldest daughter's home, setting the back of their house on fire. My infant grandchildren, ages 2 and 14 months, were asleep only a few feet away. During the investigation and approximately 12 hours later, I received a call that my home was now on fire. The losses were now reaching hundreds of thousands of dollars and putting a huge financial burden on me and my family. My husband was brought in for questioning. When he arrived, he had a gun in his car. Due to the fact that I was still waiting to get the full order of protection, no violation had been made. He was, however, taken in for the second time to the psychiatric unit for evaluation. He was held 3 days, given a new prescription of medication, and once again released. Both fires were determined arson, but I am told that there is no way they can prove this to be the work of my husband. The fact that he drives around with accelerants in his car is just part of his job, and proving anything would be difficult. I'm told a picture of him in the act would help. 3 car fires, 2 house fires, a threatening note, a written letter of his attempt to kill me and himself, and there is nothing we can do. Multiple districts were becoming involved. We feared what was yet to come. The stress my daughter was put under also put her unborn baby at risk, and arrangements had to be made to take the child early. With protection prearranged at the hospital and the other children being separated and placed in undisclosed locations until the baby could be delivered, we managed to get this accomplished. The pain was excruciating as I watched my children being separated from their children in order to keep them safe at this time. The next day after the birth of my newest grandchild, and just 1.5 weeks prior to my youngest daughter's wedding, my husband was once again arrested, this time for aggravated stalking. A $10,000 bond was set. He posted bail on his credit card and again was out within hours. We now had to take careful consideration into events leading up to the wedding. The bridal shower was canceled. People were scared. Due to the extreme measures of precaution taken by the St. Charles and St. Peter's police departments, we were able to keep the rehearsal and wedding on as scheduled. To them, we are extremely grateful. One day prior to my daughter's wedding, my husband was arrested for the third time, this time on charges of theft, a felony. During the investigation of the fire at my home, investigators uncovered some of the things I previously reported stolen out of my car. This time, a $200,000 cash-only bond was set. My husband was unable to post bond this time. Something had finally been done to give us peace, if only temporary, but the thought still lingered as how much time we had until he would be back on the street again. The courts understood the dangers, but domestic violence laws were sadly outdated and protection was minimal. He was held for 1 year. During this time, our divorce became settled. It was then, in 2007, that I was first introduced to the Safe at Home program. It was in its earliest phase of operation. The people at the Safe at Home program understood the serious nature of the threats that my family and I had been under and facilitated the review process. I decided that it was necessary to leave my job that I had held for over 20 years in order to protect the other employees. I relocated, changed my name, and got a different car. The Safe at Home program were instrumental in keeping my address and legal information confidential. My ex-husband continued to try and get his bond reduced. My family and I put ourselves at great risk at each and every hearing we pleaded with the judges. He was released without a trial, but a strict probation was set. But the terrifying letters of revenge and the heartless attacks on my family remained fresh on my mind. After being released, my ex-husband did not move on with his life. His behavior over the next year included countless attempts to take our previously settled divorce back to court, as well as hearings to have his probation changed. He even used ridiculous hearings to have me served in an attempt to locate me through a summons. If it had not been for all the help that the Safe at Home program provided at that time, I am sure that I would not be here today. They intervened, the process server, and accepted a summons on my behalf, managing to keep my personal information confidential. Within weeks of these attempts, my ex-husband returned to my brother's home, which was the last place he knew I had been living. My brother was standing in the kitchen that night when he was shot at multiple times through the windows. I thank God every day that my brother survived and was only injured from the broken glass. My brother managed to get the license plate. I pleaded with the police that this was not an isolated incident. I pleaded that they do not put this aside because someone else could be next. Their investigation found a link between the car and my ex-husband. We were now looking at possible assault charges, although to me it sounded like attempted murder. The police once again had a warrant for my ex-husband's arrest. However, this time he never made it back to jail. Instead, he committed suicide. I was numb for days. Then emotion slowly began to surface. Could this nightmare finally be over? For the first time in 5 years, I felt relief. Thank God my family is safe is all I could think. It had been 5 very long years of living in constant fear. It had consumed my life so long that I was unsure what it would be like to live life normally again. Believe it or not, this is merely a small portion of my story. However, during the past 5 years, my ex-husband's behavior resulted in multiple reports that involved various departments. I am and will always be grateful to the St. Charles Police Department and to the St. Charles Prosecuting Attorney's Office for their expertise, hard work, determination, and support in this matter. They truly stood out above the rest for their knowledge in the area of stalking. They understood the serious dangers associated with these individuals and took every precaution as they worked diligently to try and seek justice in a limited court system. I have come to realize that not all law enforcement have been as educated in this area and do not fully understand the potential dangers involved when handling these particular behaviors. I have experienced firsthand the need for better laws with stronger consequences to protect those being victimized in the future. I feel that orders of protection especially need serious review. Each time my husband was arrested and released, the violence only got worse. Allowing him to repeatedly bond out did not stop his behavior. It only enabled him to continue down a much more destructive path. These individuals are incapable of changing their own lives. They do not value their own lives, therefore expecting them to comply with rules and to suddenly value someone else's life is incomprehensible and ignores the possibility of a potentially fatal outcome. I am here today only because my ex-husband decided to take his life rather than go back to jail. I am here only because the Safe at Home program protected me when holes in the system could not. There are thousands of women and children who are currently living outside their homes, schools, and jobs in order to hide from the vicious attacks of their perpetrators. They cannot speak publicly out of fear of what might happen to them, or worse, what might happen to their children. My experience made me fully understand why individuals stay in abusive relationships. The fear of your children and family being murdered is far greater abuse than being physically injured yourself. I commend the Attorney General and everyone involved with the Domestic Violence Task Force for giving of their time to educate themselves, evaluate, and bring attention to this serious matter. It would be completely irresponsible of us to ignore the knowledge we have today. Taking necessary actions to be proactive is essential in protecting our children's future against these violent acts. We need to send the message that this behavior will not be tolerated. Allowing second, third, and fourth chances can and does result in murder. Many victims have not made it. They and their children have senselessly been murdered. Please do not let the murder of these innocent individuals and children be forgotten. We owe it to them. They were cheated out of their futures. Their families live and mourn their loss each and every day. I feel strongly that we must be the voices of these individuals and thousands of others who out of fear cannot speak for themselves. I hope that my experiences have projected a better understanding of emotional abuse and domestic violence and the serious problems within our legal system. As a voter and citizen of the state of Missouri, I, along with thousands of others, will be paying close attention to your decisions on this topic. I believe that our Missouri lawmakers and political leaders can put their differences aside and join forces on such a serious violation of its citizens. No one deserves to live under this kind of terror. Children especially do not deserve to live like this. They deserve to go back to their homes, their friends, their schools, and their jobs. They deserve to be able to lay down in their own beds at night, feeling safe and protected. They do not deserve to be victimized and feel threatened, as my children and grandchildren did in their very own homes. Thank you very much.